Welcome to Elevating Pikes Peak Women, a podcast production of Pikes Peak Women. I'm your host, Mary Lou Makepeace, and this podcast will be bringing you content relevant to the women of the Pikes Peak region in order to help them get engaged, get empowered, and make a difference in our community. Pikes Peak Women was established in 2011 in response to a need to address critical issues involving women, issues like pay equity, healthcare reform, women's rights, and social equity. Pikes Peak Women also provides forums where women can learn how to engage, become politically active, join local boards, take leadership positions, and run for office. We do this as an independent, nonpartisan organization in collaboration with other organizations whose missions support and strengthen ours. So let's dive right in. Well, hello, this is Mary Lou Makepeace, your host for this edition of Elevating Pikes Peak Women. Thank you so much for tuning in. And I have a, I don't know if he's a surprise guest, but as you know, you listeners know, I typically have women who I interview, women who are doing interesting things in Colorado Springs. Well, a month or so ago, a few weeks ago, we had Mrs. Mobilotti on the program, and her husband, Blessing, what's your whole name?
Blessing, you got that, Adeyemi Mobilotti.
Now, he wanted to be on the podcast, which pleases me, but I just have to wonder, Abby, I think he is jealous of you that you got on, and he wanted to have his space too.
True, so. True. The word out on the street is that she's a better speaker in the household.
She says you're the better cook. I guess let's just start with some background stuff. Okay. How did you come to Colorado Springs? Why did you come?
Well, Mary Lou Makepeace, first of all, thank you for having me on your show. I know traditionally and historically you have women, and I really appreciate the work that you have done to lift up the women in the Pikes Peak region. You're an example. I feel like in many ways I'm also following your footsteps. You've helped pave the way, but I know this is special for me because I get to be on your show, and this is kind of a break from the mold. So I know this is a special moment for us. So thank you for having me in on your show.
Well, you're welcome. I see you as an advocate for women, so or maybe an enabler for women in the city of Colorado Springs.
That is very true, and I know we're going to unpack some of those. So I think your question has to do with my origin story.
Yes.
Originally from Nigeria in West Africa, moved to the U.S. as an immigrant 28 years ago as a college student. I went to school in Northern Indiana, where my wife is from. We met after college. There were no plans for us to come to school in the U.S. When I say we, that's my siblings and me. There's four of us. But fate, luck, God, the stars aligned. My brother, older brother, ended up in the country. Keeping in mind that in my country, we have gone as far as we had gone. You know, finished high school, no jobs, no colleges to go to. So
not much future.
Not much future. This is why I'm so lucky to be in this country. So this experiment worked with my brother. I followed, and then my two younger sister followed. So we were all able to come to the U.S. We've all been able to stay, find community, family, work. So I spent the first 14 years in Indiana. When I did college, went into manufacturing, became a quality control manager. I love manufacturing. Then went into ministry, became a pastor because I grew up in a household of faith. And then I transitioned to Colorado. And then I've been in the Colorado area for 14 years. So 28 years in the U.S., about half and half. And yeah.
All that time in Colorado Springs? Or
no, for first 14 years was in Indiana.
No, I mean the time that you've been here in Colorado Springs.
All in Colorado Springs.
In Colorado, I should say.
All in Colorado Springs. Yeah, the 14 years I've lived here. 7 years ago, 7 years ago tomorrow, I mean, yeah, July 13th is when I became a citizen.
Well, congratulations.
Of the United States of America. Thank you. In Colorado Springs. So my citizenship anniversary is tomorrow.
Well, aren't we lucky?
Oh, thank
you. Aren't you lucky?
I am lucky too. It goes both ways.
And now you're here. And what kinds of things did you do before you? I mean, most of us could say we didn't know you.
or know of you until you decided to run for mayor.
Right.
And you kind of seemed like you burst onto the scene, but I've since learned that you worked in a number of entities,
that is
including
correct.
The city.
Right.
Why don't you talk about that?
And when people find that out, Mary Lou, I think they go, okay, that makes sense. I remember one of our first in real meetings, not in passing. I feel like I've known you in passing. We sat at the Wild Goose, a mutual friend introduced us. And by the end of the meeting, after you got to know my story, you said, why don't you decide already? Because I was still on the fence. I didn't know if I wanted to run. And you said, decide already. But part of what brought me to this journey, there's a phrase called tri-sector leadership, a triple straight leadership. It's a Harvard phrase. I learned from my participation within the Governor's Fellowship Program, class of 2019. And tri-sector leadership is leaders who have influence and impact in all three sectors. So private, nonprofit, and government. Somehow I stumbled upon my career in Colorado Springs, engaged in all three sectors, from being a business owner, for then moving into being a pastor, being an economic developer, founding new two nonprofit. Then most recent, before I became mayor, I worked in city government for 3 years as the small business development administrator. So all those, all those career experiences, some of them were volunteer, some of them were actually career, prepared me for, prepared the way for me to become mayor and now to be able to see my community and my work and my impact through all three sectors.
Well, my observation of persons who step into public leadership roles, such as the mayor, they need to have those building blocks. They need to have not necessarily expertise, but at least knowledge of all of that different parts of the community. So
it almost sounds like you've done the same.
Yeah.
No, you're right about that. It's the pathway looks different for everyone.
Certainly.
During a campaign, people would say, you don't have any political experience. And I'd say, that's okay, but I have community leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And that is experience. So to your point, there has to be some level of building blocks for you to prepare you for this level of leadership. And you don't have to have all the answers, but you have to have experience to be able to solve some of those
problems. And you better have people experience. That's critical.
Absolutely.
Well, so do you like being mayor?
I love it. I would get emotional. People often would comment that you have one of the hardest jobs in the city. Why do you have a smile on your face? And I said, when you have an army of people supporting and praying for you, feel like you can do anything. But two, even more significant, when you come from a story of humble beginnings and through hard work, fate, luck, whatever it is, but still hard work, and you're an immigrant who has wanted to participate fully in the American experience, and I'm getting all emotional, to be able to do that 7 years ago, to be able to vote and now run for office, to have this opportunity. It's hard to have bad days when you realize how powerful and significant this is. And so, do I like it? Hell yeah. It's public service. I love impact. I love serving people. It's the hardest job I've ever done. And the most rewarding job I've ever done.
I know that exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he has a tear in his eye.
I do.
So what was the impetus that you decided to say, I'm going to do
take
it?
Take the plunge. Besides Mary Lou saying, decide already.
Yeah.
So most people don't know the story behind the story. So I'm in the arena because I want to be the change I'm committed to this idea that you have to be the change you want to see in the world. Instead of looking around you, who's going to fix our problems? And in this case, some of the political challenges, I realize I have a set of strengths, experience, and my community need me. So you got to step up. I have a supportive spouse who said yes and blew me away. And she said she saw this day coming and she was praying to dear God it wouldn't come. But she sees an opportunity for us to be a blessing to the city. So besides that, a clear purpose, my clear why, my community needs my leadership, my unifying, non-political, not judgmental, humanizing people, putting people over politics, putting country over politics. I think there's room for that. And the campaign was told that story of how my leadership was going to be in the future of our city. But the real story behind that story was I was going to get involved in politics for the first time. A local leader, business leader who had sold his business, I have tremendous respect for, was going to run. Thought, hey, our city needs you from outside perspective. And I was going to get involved to support him. And he flipped the script. Vance Brown totally flipped the script and said, no, it's not me. It's you. This community needs you. I'm going to support you. And then literally wrote a check. I had no bank account. I have it sat in my drawer for months. He goes, I want to be the first person to support you. And that got the idea started. And I talked to four of the leaders, same thing. Then I said, we got to stop. I need to talk to my wife. The rest is history.
So do you feel that the community has embraced you? I mean, that we have a very complex community.
Yes, we do.
With all sorts of ideas and beliefs. And you are definitely a non-conventional
right.
Candidate. So, I mean, that's probably what got people's attention when you were running.
Right.
But do you feel now that you're in office, it's been about a year now?
Yeah, about 13 months.
And do you feel that the community has embraced you?
Yeah, as you know, it's complicated.
Right.
You have a lot of supporters. When you're at this level of leadership, political leadership, I made my peace with, as someone who is a workaholic and a type 3 in the Enneagram, and you want to be told, you're doing a great job. That's not what I signed up for. So you're always going to have supporters and you're always going to have non-supporters. The question is, how do you know? Because a lot of times we probably hear more from our supporters. It's really hard to know because we live in an echo chamber. My job is in an echo chamber. I deal with political decisions. I'm constantly trying to solve problems. I'm hearing from the people sometimes that are most unhappy. I try to make a point to engage the community. My first year alone, in 12 months, I did 250 speaking engagements. I'm doing about 4.5 a week. It gives me an idea of the community beyond just my work. But what I can tell you is, we just did some polling the results came out today.
Oh, do tell.
Yeah, I know. So this is fresh off the press. Yeah. And the polling is about 2C, the road improvement program.
Right.
And hopefully we get a chance to talk about that.
Yes.
For the November ballot. But I asked, I'm like, you know, am I a good salesperson for this initiative? How does the community feel about me? What's my favorability? So right now the poll shows about 45-46% favorability, about 24% none. And then the others, either not sure. And so,
it's a good place to start.
If you want to put it in numbers, that's where I'm currently sitting right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, being a non-conventional mayor, I am sure I had some of the same experiences.
Mary Lou, can I just make a word about non-conventional?
Yeah.
I do think, and I'm curious to hear your perspective about this, and maybe this has started even as your time as mayor. I do believe there's a growing shift in American politics to non-conventional candidates because of a frustration with the same old. So hang with me. Think about when President Obama joined the campaign and the Democrat Party said, you've only done 2 years as a senator. This is not a real thing. But the community and the country said, no, we want to give this guy a chance. Okay. After Obama, Trump. Whether you like Trump or not, but think about it's the same thing. He shows up in the Republican Party. They said what? This is not a real thing. That famous scene in the escalator, people just, and the movement of the people said, no, actually, we want to give this guy a chance. So you're seeing a lot of examples from federal, state, and even local. Many of my peers, mayors are from across the city, from across the country, are non-conventional. The moral of the story is, I think there's a tiredness of the same old. And now America is testing out non-conventional candidates. And so we're the Colorado Springs story, my story attached to the city story. I think it's an example of what's happening. And I think globally.
I agree with you. I just hadn't thought about it in that context.
That's how I've been at when I talk to political magazines and some of these national, the Washington Post. That's my perspective I've been giving them, because they're going, you're non-conventional. And I often try to ground my story in this bigger story that's happening. Yeah. Well, sometimes we get it right. Sometimes we don't get it right. Right.
Sometimes it's too non-conventional.
Exactly. I don't want to be too non-conventional.
Well, let's just take a little detour here. You have a family.
Yes.
Abby, who was on the podcast earlier.
She's amazing.
Earlier,
yep.
And three children.
Three young children. My oldest, DeWitt, he's 10 years old. We'll be 11 in November. And we were fortunate to be able to adopt him from Ethiopia. So we're adoptive parents. My middle, Alethea, we call her Tumi. She's 7 years old, going on 27.
Yep.
She's a force to be reckoned with. She strategically calls me mayor when it's convenient for her. So I'm dad and mayor, depending on what she needs. And then my youngest, he's 5 years old. He's such a cool kid. And so the struggle is real. I know a lot of your listeners understand that. And it's important for me to mention that Abby, my wife Abby, still does a lion's share of the work with our kiddos, which is another reason why I have tremendous respect for women, because not only do they have their own careers many times, and they have, and think of Abby, she has her own career as a, and I know you've talked about her story as a, in healthcare. She's first lady, and she's, because there is no such thing as 50-50. Even when the men try to help out, you know, the kids are still going to mom for everything. So.
Well, it's a little unusual for the mayor to have small children. I know I had a fairly, very young, well, forget, she was like three or something when I became mayor.
Mm.
And
she was three?
Hmm?
She was, your kids were young too?
Yeah.
Wow, I did not know that.
And then I had a teenager.
Okay.
So it's tough on them.
It is tough. I'm trying to balance public service with...
Yeah,
you know, a call to our family too. It's challenging.
Well, we saw them in the parade, and they looked like they were seasoned political kids with their waving and.
They did. I was. Yeah. I'm proud of them. It's they've accepted and Mary Lou, the call to public service is also on them. I'm really, people ask me, and maybe you're planning to ask me the question. You're a year into it. What is the most surprising thing so far? It really is not the job. The job, when you're an entrepreneur and you're used to working 80 hours a week, when you're an immigrant and you're just used to hustle, I spent 3 years in government. So my office, what used to be five offices from the previous mayor's office. So I kind of got a window into the job. But the most surprising thing for me is my family, how well they're doing. And my kids now also have the burden of being a mayor's kids.
Right.
So they're at school. They're no longer just DeWitt, Tumi, and Zion. They would do it to me and Zion, the mayor's kids. So they have a certain expectation, responsibility, and I'm really proud of how they're doing. Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, as they get a little older, there'll be some negative things that that teenager boys especially tend to lob at each other. So they'll toughen up.
We're bracing ourselves for a second term.
Yes.
Where the kids are now older and they're. They're not in that teenage, and it's different.
Yeah.
It's different, yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of the work that is going on at the city of Colorado Springs.
Okay.
First of all, I guess because we are elevating Pikes Peak women here,
yeah.
I know that you have elevated a number of women into leadership
Absolutely.
Roles in the city. And I'd like you to talk about why you have done that and what your goal is.
Right.
Because I think I told you earlier when I, back in the dark ages when I was a mayor or when I first came on city council, there was one female department head, Nancy Lewis, who was the head of Parks and Recreation. And she would talk to me about some of the hurdles of dealing with the men who were department heads. And the one that stands out in my mind is the city manager at that time, and we can talk about the different forms of government, but the city
right.
manager was having a meeting of department heads, and Nancy came in and sat down on a chair And this older, I must say crotchety, he's not around anymore, man said, "You're in my chair. Move." And, you know, she wants to go along, get along, but that's stuck in her brain. I doubt that somebody could get away with that these days.
Exactly. Yeah. We've come a long way.
Yeah, and that's good. Right. And it's been a long time. So right. Tell me about what you're doing and why you're doing it.
Well, and if it sounds like I'm over complimentary of your leadership, it's because I am. And I want to, I think one of the things you help to do as the first woman mayor is to normalize women in leadership in government. And those seeds are planted and we've come a long way. It's been slow sometimes. It's been gradual. You're right. We've come a long way since the dark ages. But I would even tell you, even 4 years ago, 5 years ago, when I joined city government, even most of our department heads were still primarily men. Were the numbers better than before? Absolutely. But I'm really pleased to report to you today, that we've seen a significant shift. I have 21 department heads. Actually, I have 23 department heads, 21 full-time, two of them interim. For the 21 department heads, 12 of them are women, 9 of them are men. For the two interim, you have one man, one woman. So when you look at our leadership right now, I mean, you're talking 13 of them are women, 10 of them are men. It's pretty incredible.
That is quite a change.
It is quite a change. And some of that is intentional.
Some of it is what?
Intentional, oh, so purposeful, okay. Yes. by design. I knew the power, and for me as mayor, when I was deciding on my chief of staff, I said it has to be a woman, because to bring that balance of leadership and that perspective, and women tend to be more collaborative than men. They tend to be more inclusive. They have an ability to see, in many ways, a big picture that sometimes we men can't see. So I was resolute that for the city government to work, we needed to balance, a mayor being a guy, but I needed a woman to be a chief of staff. So the three people I considered were all women. And so that helps also normalize it now as we begin to look at the department heads and some transition that we made. And I also, it's really important for me to say, as we've transitioned, some of these leaders, we didn't put them in power because they were women. We put them in leadership because they were very competent. For example, when my human resource officer transitioned, I asked that department, many of the managers, who do you look to for leadership in this area? And the person's name that kept coming up was a woman, and she was Hispanic. And so we gave her the opportunity to be interim for a while, and she crushed it. And she applied for the job, and we did a national search. And actually, the two finals were women, one internal, one external. And so it's really important for me to say, we're not just putting people in positions of leadership because they're women, but it's because they're very competent and they happen to be women.
Recognize the skill set
exactly
that many of the people possess.
Exactly. So yeah, I'm proud of the trajectory, and out of that is going to come some great work, I'm convinced.
How has the other staff responded? It sounds like in that case, that was their number one pick also. But how about the general population of workers, male and female?
For the most part, that's the benefit of being in a position where the buck stops with you. Mary Lou, I'm not the leader that wants to be the number one. I've fought it all my life, from college, post-college, you know, don't want to be. In fact, many times when I have the opportunity, I purposely not wanting to be the number one, the number two, three, because I just know the leadership burden of being a person where the buck stops with. The reason why I've embraced it and said yes to it is I know the unique opportunity when you are the number one and you're calling the shots and you're able to set the right culture and the right values and the right example. And that's an opportunity I have in front of me with city government. So I'm setting it. And so everybody is responding. So there's been really no issues because they're all responding to my leadership. In fact, I'm so aware of the power that I carry because of the chair that I sit, that I have to be careful and mindful even in meetings. So when meetings start and people are asking me questions, the moment I start talking, I know if I start giving my perspective, everybody all of a sudden starts to adapt their perspective to mine. So I have to exercise the discipline of, what do you think? What do you think? I need to hear yours before I actually say something. And so I bring that up as an example of, I'm in this position, I get to set the culture of who's in city leadership, and everybody's following, and there's been no issues at all.
The mistakes that I've seen, I haven't had that much experience with the strong mayor since the form of government changed, but looking at city managers or some of the subsequent mayors, people who think all wisdom is housed in them because they're the leader. I'm the mayor, I'm the city manager, I know better. And sometimes people think that that person is weak if they don't take that position, I know better.
Right.
So have you had any pushback?
The biggest pushback is within myself. I say one of the biggest challenges is self-leadership, because I still feel like I'm the imposter. How did I get here?
Right.
Do I have what it takes? I'm the little boy that's still trying to prove. And so I ask myself those questions. So I feel the pressure of being competent, feeling like I have to know everything. And I feel that from some community members, but I have to be okay with the leadership humility of I wasn't elected to know everything. I was elected for my leadership to be able to get the answers and surround myself with great people. And it's still a transition we're making societal in terms of what is real leadership. And I don't think real leadership is having the answer. In fact, if you have the answer for everything, you're either God, literally walking on earth, or you're a psychopath or a sociopath.
Or you're wrong.
Or you're wrong, because that's just not normal.
Right.
That is not normal. We're supposed to, there's a reason why I have a 3,000 person team that we hire to help solve many of our city problems, not just the mayor.
Well, let's talk. You've had some wins and you've had some losses.
I've had some losses.
And somehow the losses always get the publicity. But what are some of the wins that you perceive? I mean, you're building your team.
Right.
And that I'm taking you perceive that as a win as you move along.
Yeah.
What are some other wins?
So we, I think about 2-3 months into my job and we got Space Command. That was a huge boost of confidence. I think of when we talk about losses, one of them is 2A, asking the residents to be able to keep $5 million of the Tabor money so I can build a much needed police training academy. While that itself was as a loss, my mayor's cohort at Harvard that I'm part of were able to help me reframe it to understand that was actually a win. Because one of the things I wanted to do early, Mary Lou, was to set the tone of my leadership. Your mayor is going to pursue big, hairy, and audacious initiatives to move the community forward. Your mayor is not caught up in politics. I will support my law enforcement officers, and I will serve as a bridge between law enforcement and pockets of the community that still don't feel comfortable. And we're seeing wins in that from both sides, as now you're seeing pockets of communities are now working together. Another win is my first 100 days, we created these solutions teams in 4 areas. So public safety, infrastructure, housing, solutions, and economic vitality. And we created a teams of rivals to work together on initiatives, and that we submit solutions to the mayor's office. And the stories that came out of those meetings are unbelievable. You have a deputy chief of police and a community member that's a year to 2 years out of jail working on public safety. People are going, this has never happened before. And these are the solutions now. We're now implementing. Some other wins are the way we've engaged the community. We went to I listened in all 6 districts and we did virtual listening sessions, and people would tell me, we've never been able to give city government our perspective, and we've taken all that information now, and that's how we determine how we act on behalf of our residents. So we know homelessness is a big deal. So, because we heard it from our residents, I've always known, but there's something to be able to connect the dots with, instead of me just knowing this is an area of focus, the residents are telling me. And when they see me respond with cleanups, when they see me respond with, to protect and enforce to protect, our parks, they know that they feel like it's coming from them.
I can share a personal anecdote. I happen to live in a condominium along the creek way. And of course, that's a fairly popular place right. for homeless people to set up camps. And they're very ingenious how they can find places that are not high visibility. The police are there almost as soon as somebody reports
right.
the encampment. And it's like, I can tell you that the people that are in my building are so grateful mm-hmm. because they get a response.
Right.
And
thank you for the compliment. Some of that lives in the world of government because some of those residents, it's really important for me to humanize them, the residents. Trauma and things have happened that have caused them to live as homeless residents. But it really is important to strike that balance between compassion and also ensuring that we're protecting our community. And the number of fires that are started in those encampments are many.
Yes.
That's our biggest fire danger. It's not even wildland fire. It's some of those. So I have to invest in street outreach. It's a hot team, the homeless outreach team, but it's also the homeless outreach program, behavioral health specialists who are working with these residents to guide them from the streets back into housing, work, and health. So those are when, we have wins. We're getting to authorize strike now with our police department so that will help improve response time. When I was started, it was about 70 to 80 short. Now we're only 20 short. But here's the biggest win. I really want to share
okay.
this. It's not even,
da-da-da.
I know it's not even just what we got done. It is the number of people that stopped me on the street that said, and I'm getting the goosebumps, you're actually doing the things you said you're going to do. The first time somebody told me that 3-4 months into the job, because things like I'm going to appoint a housing officer, I'm going to have a workforce administrator to solve our workforce problems. We were doing everything that we said we're going to do. And when the first time I got that as a compliment, Mary Lou, I was so confused because I thought, why is that a compliment? Then I realized our residents are used to candidates say one thing and then they go in the office and say another. But when people would say, you're actually doing the things you said you were going to do, I did.
That's a high compliment.
Yeah, I meant it. I said I was going to engage residents in a decision-making table. We're doing that. I said we're going to do all these things. We're doing that. So I take that as a strong win because we'll use that to build trust because I have a lot of work ahead of me. And the foundation of trust is going to be important to get more things done.
Well, a couple more things I want to bring up that are, I think, important.
Okay.
And one is working with city council.
Mm.
And I would like to just explain what it was like before we had a strong mayor. We had a city manager, and a council and a mayor. And the city manager was exactly that, managed the staff, did not have the ability to make rules and regulations, did have to come to the mayor and the city council. So there was a process that it was both ways, city council to
right.
the city manager and the city manager to the city council. As the mayor, my authority was the power of my persuasion that I didn't have any, I was not, I had one vote just like the city council members had.
Right.
Now we have a strong mayor. We don't have a city manager anymore, but
right.
I'm sure there's somebody that you have, a chief of staff. It's
a chief of staff.
And a council that almost seems from the outside to be going along on their own path. And I just would like to get your perspective on that.
It is the 13 years ago, we made that transition. We're one of three cities in the state of Colorado that have a strong mayor system, Denver, Pueblo, and Colorado Springs. I don't know how your listeners feel about that transition, but I fully support it because it's the way of democracy on the federal level.
I think that it is absolutely.
You have the executive, legislative, and judicial. Here we have the executive and legislative, and it's good to separate those. So, of course, we have our own priorities. Of course, we have our own strategic plans. Of course, we have to figure out how best to work together. But that is the work of democracy. That the very essence of democracy is a competition of ideas, is a competition of branches, is banging our heads together to do the hard work of what is the best decision for our city and to separate the functions for checks and balances. So one branch is not too powerful where for example, I just appointed a new public works director. City council had to vote on it. So guess what? They have to be a part of my hiring process. I would have done that anyway because I'm an Abraham Lincoln type of leader. So, but even more so, no matter who's in power, it forces you to work with your colleagues, whether you work well or not. We have to do the hard work of democracy. They're involved in the hiring process actually before it gets to the chambers and they vote on. So we mutually vote on these roles as the best person to deliver those quality services for our residents. So the pluses, there are also a lot of challenges to that design. And challenges are okay. The main thing I'd like to see is to just ensure we hold on to civility and how we make those decisions, how we debate, how we argue, and what we do in public, what we do behind closed doors, how we support each other. All those things matter. And that's the opportunity we get to teach the next generation of how to lead with a whole bunch of people that have competing interest.
Just to clarify, you don't have any authority over city council.
I do not have any authority. Mm-hmm. I have a seat on the dais. They would always ask, does mayor's business? So my chief of staff sits there to help represent me. Every once in a while, I show up for things that are really important and I address my colleagues from the podium, but they are an independent branch outside of me. I'm an independent branch outside of them. My job is to get things done, to enforce laws and policies and make things happen. I do have a certain level of administrative regulation power, but city council's job is to, they're more on the legislative side of things, the land use issues. So they get to decide land use issues. I execute. So we have separate authority, but it's important, Mary Lou, that we work well together. We talk. One of the things I did when I became mayor that historically has not been done, once a week on a Friday, so today, I meet with the president of city council. So, and that is, I did that in part to ensure that we are talking. So we exchange notes. What's happening on your side, Councilmember Helms, Mayor Yemi, what's happening on your side? And we're constantly talking amongst ourselves so there are no surprises.
I guess what sticks in my brain is a recent kerfuffle on city council mm-hmm. where they're having some differences of opinion, which I guess every council has
right.
a member that seems almost to be a renegade. How do you perceive that? I know how I perceive it. I thought it was embarrassing for the city and for city council that played out in public.
Right.
These are some guys I don't know. And
right. In a perfect world, Mary Lou, that should have not played out in public, but it is what it is. We're here now. And while it was a public experience, beyond the initial what sparked this special session, I'm actually proud of all 9 council members and how they handled themselves in that special session. I'm not saying that I'm supporting every council member's opinion, but I feel like it's incumbent upon us to, again, be good examples of democracy.
Listened to the tape of that, and I thought the council members were pretty civilized in how they are respectful as they went around. And
which is hard to do.
Yes.
That is hard. So you got to give them credit because it's, and you get this, inside you're feeling a certain way, but outside you have to, it's almost like the duck in a pond, you know, just kind of moving through the water, but the feet is
good analogy.
Exactly. You just got to give them credit for that leadership. And because it was hard, whichever way your listeners fall on the side of what went down, I think at the end of the day, I consider good leadership a win. I often tell that my team, we're going to get a lot of stuff done. We have an exciting announcement coming up in August. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Can't share.
Can't share. Sorry. We have a few things coming up and I'm really excited about. The point I'm making is we're going to get a lot of stuff done. But my team knows, I always say, what's important also, as important, is how we get it done. The process is as important as the outcome. The process.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so Abraham Lincoln, my favorite quote of his is, he would say, give me 6 hours to chop down a tree and I will spend the first 4 hours sharpening the axe. It's not just about chopping down the tree. It's about how we get to the place of chopping down the tree. Respect, civility, stakeholder engagement, engaging citizens, all those things are important.
Well, I think that the staff probably is familiar with this kind of perspective, but it seems like sometimes elected officials, and I won't just look at city council, but that's our focus right now, is they forget that they are judged not individual by individual. They're judged as a body. So when one of them misses or is inappropriate, the whole body is judged as unprofessional or inappropriate. So I hope that this incident that we experienced has calmed down for the good of the city.
It has calmed down. We saw that in the last city council session, general session. I think there was a lot of nervousness into going into this last Tuesday, but everything actually ended up way better than I expected.
Yeah. Well, they're fairly new. Most of them are fairly new into the public political role. And so hopefully that was a learning experience. I mean, when I came on, we had Bob Isaac and Leon Young and, you know, people.
You had all the legends.
Yeah, exactly.
Your class was a whole bunch of legends.
Yeah.
Think of Bob Isaac, Leon Young, you.
Frank Parisi.
Wow.
Anyway.
Was that before Lionel?
That's before Lionel.
Before Lionel.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yep. Well, tell me about 2C. I know that's an important thing that is coming up.
Absolutely.
And talk about it.
Yeah.
You're going to go to the voters again.
Yes. My Colorado Springs peeps, I need you. I need you to show up this November 5th. It's going to be a very crowded ballot, as I'm learning. There is probably going to be one of the longest, I think 3 pages, unfortunately. But hang in there. Please do not lose hope. A lot of the things you're going to be voting, not very many local. I'll get to 2C in a little bit. But on the state level, the number of state initiatives, so please take your time to read it, understand it, because they will impact your quality of life. In terms of local, the main one and for the city of Colorado Springs residents is 2C. 2C is a road improvement program that started in 2015 by Mayor John Southers, got renewed in 2019, and I'm asking for us to renew it in 2024. The city has had 30 plus years of deferred maintenance. Those of us that have lived here long enough, we remember the days before when potholes were just atrocious because we didn't have our own ability to take care of our own potholes. We removed that tax initiative, and then we just weren't fixing our roads. The good news is that we've been doing that. We have a lot of progress. We've repaved about 1,700 lane miles, equivalent from Colorado Springs to Athens, Georgia. But to repave the whole city, about another 5,000-6,000 left, we have to repave equivalent from Colorado Springs to Athens, Greece, to give you a visual vastness of the work. Since we started this program, we've reduced the number of claims against the city by 80%. 80%. It's dropped significantly. Since we started this program, we've reduced a number of complaints, pothole complaints, by 40%. And here's why. Repairing potholes is just a band-aid solution. We go in and fix it. This freeze-thaw every winter to spring is part of the curse of living here. There's a lot of blessing, 300 days of sunshine, a mountain. But with this freeze-thaw cycle, puts a number in our roads. Unlike if you come from the Midwest like I did, the whole thing just freezes the whole season. And then spring, then it thaws. Yeah. But fixing potholes, it's only a band-aid solution. We literally have to go and take it out and repave the whole thing. And then it gives us a longer runway And then we actually protect our investment. So that is the work we're doing. It's working. Up to this point, it's been 5-year ballot initiative, which is, there's wisdom in that. We're gonna allow the city to take a little bit of this, our sales tax money, but let's see what they do with it. We've shown it worked in 2015. In 2019, it passed again. So this time, you know, we have a lot more data and we're bringing it now to the neighborhoods, to the residential street. And we've done primary and secondary roads. Now the residents and the voters can expect to see it come to their neighborhoods. And so, we're going to be asking the voters to vote, yes on this road improvement initiative that's going to be on the November ballot.
And it's 2C.
It is 2C. Well,
or not.
Lord willing, it's 2C. Okay. It was 2C in 2015, of course. We were lucky to get it in 2019. We hope we can get it to be 2C again so that people are not confused.
How many miles do we have that we are challenged with?
To repave?
Well, yeah.
About another 5,000. That's what we have to go. Oh, and here's something cool, Mary Lou. I know you would appreciate this. We actually had a 2C media event this morning that I spoke at. We've done about 4 or 5 of these. So this is work that the city is doing anyway. We're using it as a way to capitalize for the mayor to show up as a way to promote the November ballot initiative. So I fix potholes myself as part of this. It's hard work. Yeah. This morning we did a hot in place project. It's a pilot testing where we're repairing roads with existing asphalt. So it's sustainable. It's good for the environment. So instead of just taking out huge chunks of asphalt and replacing them, we're actually now trying to test out reusing old asphalt with a combination of new asphalt to repave the roads. And hopefully it will save us more money and time.
Well, and as you drive by those city workers who are doing that work in this temperature, oh my God, it's like you want to
feel. So it was important for me. It was important for me to get out there and actually get a chance to do their work. It's hard work. I think after fixing those, using that equipment to fix those potholes for the next 3 days, my arms were just sore. It's hard work. The public servants, I know it's inconvenient for many of our residents. Please hang in there. The work that they're doing is really to make our roads smooth and safe.
Will you, by the time the ballot question comes around, will you have prioritized areas so people know that something's going to happen in their neighborhood?
Well said. Now, the ballot in language itself it's not writing names of roads, but it's saying we're going to do these projects. So residential street and things like that. Now we do have a list of roads. And if folks want to know more about the 2C campaign, just the 2C program, what we've done, if you want to see if your road is on the list, go to coloradosprings.gov/2C or just go to coloradosprings.gov and you see a link to 2C. It tells the story, the before and after. You type in your address, you can see if you're on the list. There's a way we go through, there's a process we go about choosing the roads across the city. We're not picking winners and losers. There is a Ghostbuster looking type car that every 2 years this vehicle with software, cameras, I mean, it makes its way throughout the city, all 200 square miles of the city. And we are assessing the condition of the roads. And so from there, we see what's most vulnerable and then we address the most vulnerable streets in the city. And that's how we make those decisions.
Well, what do you do with citizens who call in and say, you know, the road in front of my house is ridiculous and you haven't done anything to it and blah, blah, blah?
Please call us because there are times because we also have to do, when we do those roads by law, we're required to do the sidewalks and curbs and gutters for accessibility, ADA accessibility, which I'm really happy to know. But there are times where we do get those phone calls from people who say, my sidewalk is so bad. My aging parent, if they walk on this, they're going to get hurt. We actually go back and take a second look and see if we need to reprioritize. Because the last thing we want is for a resident to get hurt, even if they may not be on the list for, if they, we're not going to get to them for another year. But we might have to shift things around to make it work.
The same with roads. If somebody calls about potholes on their road by their house.
With potholes, please report it ASAP. You are my eyes in the community, because we don't drive around. We don't have the resources to drive around to see where the potholes are. So we depend on residents on their drive, being able to call the city, use the app GoCOS. It's a great way to report any of your issues, not just potholes. But that one we will address. That one is easy. Excuse me.
One more thing. I mean, it sounds to me like we've got a plan in place for doing the work. What we need now is citizens to approve the resources to do the
Bingo.
Work. If it doesn't pass, then we don't have the resources.
That's it. If it doesn't pass, we're back to the days of pre-2015. Okay. And if you're new in the community, you don't know those days. But ask anyone who's lived here longer,
right.
And it's just years of 30-plus years of deferred maintenance, and we can't go back there.
So what does it actually ask for? It's a sales tax?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
It's without raising taxes, it's a 0.57 cents on every $10 purchase. That's how to think about it.
Okay.
So 57 cents on every $10 purchase that the city keeps. And we use that money for the 2C initiative. When this started, it started at 62 cents. And then we reduced it. We felt like we could reduce it. We reduced it. And now we just said, let's keep this. And then we're extending it now instead of 5 years, 10 years. The, okay. You know, good news is, another again, these results from the polling just came today. The 10-year for 2C is polling better than 5 years. That's pretty cool. 10 points better.
You do a lot of polling.
Well, I should say, when you do a polling, you try to ask all the questions because it costs money. So all of this is from the most recent polling.
Okay.
And the last time we polled 2C was in February. So to give you an idea of.
I'm curious about the ambulance service.
Where are we at with that?
You know, I know, as lived here a long time, I know that that's kind of come and gone. And
right. I mean, for 45 years or so, we've been doing the same thing. So we've outsourced it to a private company. What's important for our listeners to know is that there was wisdom in doing that, because many times government may not be in the best position to deliver a service. The challenge we're having is that the 911 landscape has changed so much. We want to be innovative. We want to be able to address homelessness, because all those calls come to me, the tiered response. We don't need to send an officer to every call. They don't want to address every call because they know that when they show up, situations escalate. So there are times we need to send a behavioral health person. So it's time that we need to send like a nurse practitioner. The private ambulance company is the one piece of our public safety program and 911 that we have no control over. Even though it's a responsibility of government by law and city code, at the end of the day, it's my job. So they're not able to adapt to this needs. They're not able to meet the response time, and they're asking the city to reduce the expectation and also to pay them more money. So it's an impact on my general fund. Nationally, you see this trend away from private ambulances for the same reason I mentioned. In 2006, Grand Junction moved away from private ambulance. In 2020, Boulder moved away from private ambulance. You see this movement in the country because we realize that we should be in charge. It's like saying, you know, I'm going to give 20% of my public safety services to a security company. So that's what the problem we're trying to solve. And
I confess I wasn't following that as closely as
Mary Lou. That's why it didn't. I'm just kidding.
Yes, I know. Well, what would it cost? I mean, I heard some former council members say, oh, we thought about that and it was just too expensive by the time we bought the vehicles or whatever. I don't know.
There's a cost. There's a cost to like everything. What our listeners need to know is 100 years ago, a group of residents and leaders said, we believe we should have our own municipal utility company. Think about how significant that was back then.
Right.
A $1.6 billion entity right now, bigger than the city budget.
Not only do we want our utilities, but we're going to haul water across the mountains to get it here. That was some big thinking.
And this is what my challenge to the city was. If 100 years ago we did this, we have shown we're the prototype city for enterprises, utility, airport, stormwater, you name it. I mean, we have examples of great government self-sustaining entities that has no impact on the general fund. It protects our taxpayers because this thing has to be profitable. So yes, is there a startup cost? Absolutely, like everything. Here's also what we have in our city. Issue 300, a Tabor initiative, prevents using city assets or city finances to start any new kind of enterprise. So we actually have foundations like Lighter Hill and El Pomar and Catalytic Foundation set up to give this new EMS enterprise grant money that we didn't have to pay, and then some loans that we would have to pay to the tune of, we were looking at about $5 to $7 million to start up this new enterprise. And because it's a profitable entity, make no mistake about it, the reason why the private enterprises want it, especially because of TRICARE being in a military community, it's profitable. Our numbers were so conservative, we were able to show that we would pay it off in 5 years. So all those startup capital, we don't have to pay off the free money from the foundations, thank you. But the loans, we pay that off in 5 years. And then any surplus income, guess what? Goes back to our public safety needs. And here's the icing on the cake. There are $6 to $7 million that all public sector, that if you're about our size, that comes from the feds through the state, that public sector EMS get to have these extra money, supplemental money from government that will help this enterprise that is not available to private enterprises, which would have even helped us pay off those loans even faster than 5 years.
Well, I have a couple of quick questions. Was all of that presented to city council when they had to make that decision?
Yeah, it was. And this is the work of democracy. What our residents don't know is that before we brought that to city council, we've been at this for 10 months. In fact, when my team brought it to me, I said, no one talks to me about this until we've done work. Let's bring in some outside perspective. Let's bring in citizen auditors. And so even before they brought it to me, 3 months, they did a deeper dive. And when they presented it to me, I was won over. And then we immediately started engaging council members. We knew where council would be. So by the time we got to the public, we've been engaging some council members for 7 months. And I don't think that would have changed your mind. What we didn't see coming was one of the council members changing their vote. If we saw that coming, I probably wouldn't have brought it to the general session. Yeah.
And maybe you can't answer this, I don't know, but what was the stated rationale for not supporting it? I mean, just our conversation.
No, I'm happy to tell them you that, because many of these council members are still colleagues of mine, and I still work well with them. You know, I've one of them said we need more time. One of them said that they're still not comfortable with the payer mix. So that's the mix of payment and the collection system. They had questions around the numbers. There was just a variety of, ultimately, here's what I think the biggest concern is. We've never done this. This feels like too much of a risk. And I said, you're right. It is a risk, but it's a calculated risk. I would never, because this is all me, keep that in mind, I would not want to do anything to hinder my own success. But this is a calculated risk. When the guy, his name is Barry Baum, who voted no in 2019, the city was a leading proposal for the RFP. I don't know if people know this. In 2019, we competed against the private ambulances. We came out on top. We just didn't have a way to execute it because of issue 300 that doesn't allow you using city assets to start up a new enterprise. But we've cracked that code with the foundations. But Barry Baum, one of the citizen auditor, voted no against this and voted in favor of one of the private enterprise, when a guy like Barry Baum, who we've presented information on this EMS, comes back to me and says, Mayor, this is a good idea. And I'm going, whoa, you voted no. He goes, yes, but let me tell you why I'm saying yes. You gave me access to the information. In an RFP, it's a closed process. Only few people know what's going on. You know what I did? I gave it to the whole community. And I invited him to be a part of this, because if guys like Barry had said, Mayor, we have done the hard work and this is a bad deal, that I would have probably gone, I'm not doing this. But when a guy like Barry says, I have assessed the short-term risk, the long-term risk, you guys have adapted everything, you've done the work, and this is a good decision for our community, that gives me the comfort to go, this risk is worth it. It's a risk regardless, and it's just a fear of the unknown that is keeping some of our community members from doing it.
Again, we have a council that has limited experience, and so as they gain more experience, I don't know, they may be braver.
Right, exactly. Yeah. We have to take, as elected officials, we have to take pragmatic, sensible, good risk for our community, because the problems are in housing. You know, we could talk about housing. We could talk about community activation. We could talk about economic vitality. We're not going to move our community forward by playing it safe.
Right.
You know, so we have to take some level of risk, but it has to be calculated. It has to be smart. It can't be foolish.
Well, what's next with EMS?
That's a great question. So we're still in the game. The contract ends in April of 2025. We reached out to AMR to extend the contract for 1 year. We're also considering doing an RFP process. And if we do, the city will also compete against the RFP process. Then I'm also talking to council members about different other types of ideas, and also working with them to say, what would it take for you to say yes? I've had a couple of council members strangely said, instead of an enterprise, they voted no, but they're saying, this thing should be, what do you think about putting this in a general fund? And I go, well, we're trying to protect the general fund. So that's interesting. I don't know if I want to pursue that, but the point is working with those council members that voted no to say, what would it take to help you get to a yes? Because at the end of the day, we need this. The writing is on the wall. It is going to happen. And if something happens, Mary Lou, where an ambulance doesn't get there on time or something, I'm still liable. That's what this community doesn't realize. At the end of the day, I am liable. At the end of the day, my fire engine is still at the scene. It's a waste of resources. I send my firefighters. They're the first ones at the scene. They triage the situation. Then they sit and wait for an ambulance.
Well, we have chatted now for an hour. And are there other things that you wanted to bring up that we haven't touched on?
You know, I just want to leave it on a positive note. We haven't talked about housing. Affordable housing keeps me up at night for my kids, the next generation, our workforce. We have some innovative solutions in how we remove barriers to get more housing. I know there's a lot of angst around growth. I see you. I hear you. I am not about foolish growth. I'm about intelligent growth. I often say, like kids, you know, you have kids, they're going to grow anyway. But as parents, we want to help them grow well. So we're working on those too. For those who are worried about that, you have my commitment to be proactive, transparent, and also approachable. No doubt, I came from a different pathway. I am not trying to build. I don't have to answer to anybody. I'm not trying to build my own empire. You don't have to worry about this, Mayor. So just keeping that in mind. But I do want to end with a high note that Colorado Springs was ranked the number 3 best city to live in the U.S. It's a big deal. And we're still the number 1 most desirable city. So with all our pain points, the question about desirability, you want to know what it is? The question about desirability by U.S. News and World Report, the question says, what's a city in America you would like to visit or live? Whether or not they do that, but when they ask this question across America, people are saying it's Colorado Springs. Think about how significant that is. So we're going to build on that accolade to fix the rest of our problem, because it's got to be desirable for every single person, not just for some.
Well, and this probably isn't a positive note, but I think people are not as concerned about growth as I can't even think of the saying now. We have this wonderful mountain backdrop.
Right.
And yet my personal feelings, we have someone who wants to build this
skyscraper.
And I know from other cities, you have one, soon you have six or seven. And then we have the annexation that's going down to Fountain. And it's like, the way I understand that is that Colorado Springs taxpayers would subsidize that development. I don't think those are wise decisions.
Right.
And I think people would accept growth if they thought we were making wise decisions.
Well said. Well said.
Yeah.
And it's incumbent on me and all the elected officials to ensure that we're making wise decisions. And the process of how we make those decisions is really important. No, that's it. Well said. And ultimately, we all understand that our resources are limited. We all understand that we want to protect our great mountain views and enhance our quality of life. That's what we're fighting for. And to your point, they want to be able to trust that the government is making the best decision on their behalf. So,
yeah. So
that's not a depressing note. That's just reality.
That's reality.
Yeah, that's reality.
And
yeah.
Sometimes I think we need to talk more about the anxiety of those decisions. And I mean, I know the city has processes, of course, but like in the case of an annexation or a development, I think about the development up on the hill.
Right.
That's been refused a couple times, and now it's been approved. Why would it get approved this time and not previous times?
Right.
And those are things that citizens don't understand.
Right.
There's probably some logic there.
Right.
But I don't get it. And my neighbors don't get it.
It's a process. And this is democracy. And this is where, even with my own bully pulpit, I hear from residents, they want me to either stop a project, start a project. And the moment I step into that realm, that is the world I left, Mary Lou. Kind of like the president, the mayor having single authority, because I opened that door, that window. Where does it stop? There's got to be a process for how to get to decisions. This is why our people, our residents, have to show up. On all sides of the issue, you got to show up, because we're not going to move our city forward by your 10 elected officials just abusing their power. There is a process. So people often forget that a lot of these land use issues, before it comes our way, are determined by a group of residents. This is democracy. They're called the Planning Commission. They're not elected. They are residents. So be a part of Planning Commission. Let's get you involved in some of those decisions, because a group of your representatives are saying, this project fits the right criteria, and we're going to move it to city council. The mayor doesn't get to weigh in.
Right.
Our earlier conversation, branches of government. Mayor, you have a lot of power. If it's done right, I shouldn't be using my power incorrectly. Now you're getting to the elected officials. But keep in mind, a group of everyday citizens moved it forward. You should be talking to them as well. Like, there's got to be a process to get, there are a lot of people that don't like the building, that tiny footprint that doesn't allow, that have building height. But Mayor Lionel Rivera was mayor at the time in 2006 when that process was established with a group of residents. We have to go back to that process to change that. And I think that's where it gets confusing for our residents. How do we affect change? But the mayor just saying, I'm going to stop this project, that is dangerous.
No, I don't think you should do that either.
Right.
But that is, I think that people... and this is probably not right for the podcast. Let's finish this. Uh-huh. You know, Yemi, thank you so much for being
thank
here.
Thank you so much for having
and,
me.
And
I hope this has been educational for our listeners, just to trying to understand the local government a little bit more. Yeah.
Well, local government is very complicated.
Very much so.
And it's true.
And get involved in local. It's a I'm not saying don't vote in November. Vote in November. Vote for who's going to be the next president. But understand the decisions I make and council make and your planning commission make actually affects your quality of life more than some of the national fighting. So make sure you get involved locally.
Thank you. And I think that wraps it up for today. If you're still with us and still listening, thank you for being, this is one way that you get involved is to listen to someone who can share the information. I know the city is pretty open and there's a wonderful website. They have everything
ColoradoSprings.gov.
Yeah.
And the 1,000 Neighborhood Gathering. Sign up.
Thank you all. And for more information, check out our show notes. If you're interested in learning more about Pikes Peak Women, visit us on Facebook. Until our next episode, I'm your host, Mary Lou Makepeace. Thanks for listening to Elevating Pikes Peak Women. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and if so, please consider leaving a review wherever you listen to podcasts or share with your friends on social media or in person.